All right, so it's 1:45. Thank you all for coming out. We're excited actually to deliver the first Link session here at Tech Ready 2012 in Australia for Link 2013 preview, right? So this is still pre-release code. We'll talk a little bit more of that in a moment. My name is Andrew Aronsing. I work for Microsoft Consulting Services. I'm based out of Chicago in the US. My job is to cover our UC products, Link and Exchange in the Americas region. From a services perspective, from both pre-sales and deployment. So my job is kind of QA, projects that are in flight out in the field, provide some of that background or feedback to the product groups internally, as well as to deliver sessions like this, both inside Microsoft and to public audience.
Hi, my name is Ewan McKellar. I'm a premier field engineer based out of Brisbane, and for the last couple of months I've been seconded into the global CTS team doing beta support for TAP customers. So if you're a TAP customer and you have Link 2013 and anything goes wrong with it, I'm the guy who has to try and fix it, or at least one of a team of guys who fixes it.
Excellent. Thank you, Ewan. So as we said, right, first of all, this is pre-release code, which means that all information that we're about to show you is subject to change. Don't take this as the authoritative source of information going forward. This is our best guidance that we know at this time. We expect a few changes from here, but want to give you that the heads up that obviously anything we say can be tuned, specifically around things like performance and sizing as we're going through that exercise in the code base right now. So. With that, let's get started. Link 2013 is a sixth, seventh iteration of our real-time communication server product. We had acquired a company back in the late 90s that did a SIP session establishment, sort of corporate IM capabilities. We rolled that initially into Exchange 2000 conferencing server using the Windows Messenger client and Windows XP as a way to provide instant messaging services inside of an organization. But we realized that, as well as most of the industry, right, that the concept of data networks and voice networks were converging, and there was this concept of running media or having media flow occur over data networks. In essence, for that media flow to occur, we needed the concept of something called session management, right? So we need to be able to establish a session between two different endpoints, help negotiate what those IP addresses are and or ports that they can communicate with, and then have a codec that we can use to stream that media between those endpoints. And so we spun our code base out of Exchange and into a separate group, the Real-Time Collaborations Group. You might see some references in some cases to RTC Service and RTC Local, right, inside of the OCS and the Link Server products. That code base has turned into Live Communication Server 2003 and 2005. We started to add some voice integration capabilities around things like remote call control, eventually into Office Communication Server 2007 and Office Communication Server 2007 R2, where we continue to expand this concept of real-time collaboration. We added things like conferencing, for example, video and voice, right? All these just being different versions of media or codecs that would flow between either two endpoints and a point-to-point call or to an MCU and a multi-party call. Eventually, in 2010, we released and rebranded the product from OCS 2007 R2 to the simpler name Microsoft Link. That was released a couple years ago with great success. So we're seeing incredible adoption of Link in the marketplace around everything from instant messaging to conferencing to organizations going and deploying their voice services on top of Link. And now we're pleased to present to you in our public disclosure, right? If you look around, you won't see a lot of content on Link 2013 outside of TechNet, for example. We haven't had any events prior to this where we're disclosing the new products, and so we're happy to present Link 2013. On this session, we're going to cover the architectural changes of Link. We're going to try to get through all the essentially new features provided by Link 2013 and a little bit of the underpinnings of how some of those features work. If our demo gods are looking kindly upon us, we'll show you a pool failover between the two, but of course, having Ewan as one of our beta support engineers, we expect that process to go relatively smoothly. but of course, right, beta code and new stuff, we have to put the little preface in there. So what about Link? What's the kind of the overview of Link, right? The first one is this is really our first shipping version where we have a truly homogenous version of the product. We've had a couple acquisitions along the way. Placeware, for example, became Live Meeting and then rolled into the AB MCU inside of Link 2010, so we had a single client for that meeting experience. We also had the acquisition of Parlano around group chat. And so now we have a unified persistent chat experience inside of Link 2013 as well. And so with Link 2010, you saw us move that meeting experience from having an OCS client and a live meeting client into a single client. With Link 2013, we're now extending that meeting capability and adding the persistent chat capabilities there. So a single interface from an end user perspective, we feel makes it easier then to leverage all the capabilities and modalities inside of Link. It still leverages Active Directory. So once you've, Active Directory is the world's most widely deployed enterprise authorization and authentication mechanism. Organizations store name, email address, phone numbers, right, SIP address, the user's passwords, their group membership inside of Active Directory. Link relies on that Active Directory backbone to provide that directory and authentication service. Advantage for you is you don't have separate usernames and passwords for conferencing versus setting up a phone call, right, versus a different PIN or extension required for anything from voicemail or other functionality or features. All that stored in Active Directory on the user object. We don't have that separate silo of administration for persistent chat or other Link features. All that's based inside of Active Directory. We've also added the integration with Office. One of the new change points here is we understand that a large use case of Link is the concept of enhancing the communications experience, which is often something as simple as sharing out a document or a PowerPoint or Excel workbook, for example. And so with Link 2013, we no longer require you to go to the Link client to start that communications and sharing. You can now start that sharing natively from the Office 2013 series of applications. Part of what we call dynamic workplace as well. Our internally, this Wave 2013 of Exchange and Link and SharePoint is the first time we've really had the product groups attempt to work very closely together. So rather than having an individual group doing SharePoint and Exchange and Link and maybe not necessarily the same look and feel or administrative interface, we had a lot more collaboration in the development effort to ensure that we did have that consistency across the products, as well as to ensure that if one product had a capability or feature, that would be leveraged by the others. So we see things such as the unified contact store and Exchange to consolidate data storage, the Discovery Center for compliance and archiving running across the three products, for example. So we're seeing a further level of integration, essentially, between our back office products, SharePoint, Link, and Exchange, to provide that consistent look and feel from an end user perspective. We've also had investments around availability and site resilience. We'll talk at length about that in some of the slides coming up, but a lot of investment essentially around the capability of enhancing that term concept of availability. We want your Link experience as an end user to remain up with the expectation that the back-end infrastructure will have outages, right? So we will have hardware failures. You will have Patch Tuesday. You will have instances where servers are going up and down on the back-end. But at the same time, we want that end user or the concept of the Link service to remain available. One of the ways we were actually able to enhance this in Link is about 3 or 4 years ago, across our back office story of products, so the components in Dynamic Workplace, we had the developers go from just writing code for the on-prem and our cloud versions of the software to going on call. So when our service would go down, right, rather than having that go up through our traditional escalation path, and then finally when we couldn't resolve it, engaging a member of the development community during business hours to try to fix it, we put them on call 24/7. And that feedback loop of having the developers writing the code, right, that ships both on-premise and in the cloud, being responsible for outages, had a surprising impact on the level of availability and operations and providing telemetry back, right? So just having them engaged at that level, we found made the code base stronger, more resilient, and more durable for that concept of providing a back-end infrastructure that's simpler to operate, has more clear error messages, and that when there's an outage, provides the appropriate telemetry to engage or to augment that sort of troubleshooting capability that we have. And that really applies around increasing efficiency and reducing costs. We don't want you all to have to go out and become a Link certified master just to deploy and run and operate Link, right? It's nice to have that advanced knowledge, but the goal should be this should be straightforward, easy to deploy, easy to manage, and easy to set up. So let's take a look. Oops, went the wrong way there. Let's take a look and see what our choices are. The first couple of slides will show you is your Link deployment options. And we really have three ways that you can deploy Link Server 2013. The first one, we're calling Link Server. So this is what you're familiar with today. If you have an on-premise version of Microsoft software, you purchase some licenses from us, you deploy some servers. Those servers have a variety of server roles. You deploy those, you operate it. It is not connected in any way back to Microsoft or to a cloud service. And it has all the capabilities and functionality in Link. This is the most widely deployed concept. At the same time, we've seen customers asking us to operate in the cloud, right? We want to have some options for the cloud. And so with Link, we have the Link Server option. The Link Server option has the most, all of the feature sets essentially available in Link. But we have two other choices as well now around hybrid and Link Online. And so we take a look at these. The first one, Link Online, is a subset of what you would get with Link Server deployed on-premises. But with this subset, you have the capability of having that Microsoft financially backed SLA. If we have an outage, we actually will pay you for that downtime, right? This is a not just a lip service, but an actual guarantee backed by our checkbook. And so essentially, you're outsourcing some of that operations cost to our support staff and essentially to those developers who are tasked with writing the product and improving it. Reduced administration, obviously, you're going to have the concept of your control panel, right, for provisioning users and sort of managing it. But we'll take care of the back-end infrastructure and plumbing. We also have the option with the Office 2013 client of something called Click to Run. So we use the AppD virtualization capability, where now we can stream the client down to desktops, and we don't require you to use a traditional MSI, MSP-based approach for installing that local Office client software. The Link 2013 client is no longer a separate application. It is part of the Office 2013 family of products. And so when you install Office, you're choosing Word or Excel or PowerPoint and Outlook, as well as Link now as one of the options to make it part of that cohesive package. The third one that we're happy to announce is what we call Link Hybrid. Link also represents some challenges for a typical cloud-based deployment, specifically around the concept of telephony. We have the concept of phone numbers, billing systems, carrier relationships, right? And when moving to a cloud service, if the cloud service doesn't have those capabilities, obviously we're prevented from providing some of those Link features to you. We'll talk a lot more about the hybrid in the voice session tomorrow afternoon. We'll kind of go through how this process works, but essentially it allows you to deploy some Link software on-premises and then use that to integrate with your existing carriers, your PBX, your PSDN connections, session border controllers, for example, but still have a concept of the instant messaging and the conferencing workload being hosted online or in the cloud. So you run the voice component to Link, but we'll take care of the instant messaging and conferencing aspects for you with the Link hybrid solution or Link hybrid approach. So three choices of how you can deploy it. We'll go into the technical difference of those, as we said, in the voice session tomorrow afternoon. We also mentioned early on, right, the concept of an integrated system. We've had presence in IM, enterprise voice, and the audio, video, and web conferencing capabilities in Link 2010. With Link 2013, we're happy to bring you now the concept of mobility and persistent chat into that fold. So same management tools, topology builder, services being co-located on the front-end services, our front-end servers, so we don't have that concept of server sprawl or multiple different server roles you need to manage, operate, patch, for example, to try to bring some consistency around that deployment and operational approach. Enterprise voice, we've also made a substantial number of changes. We've got the little table here on the right we'll kind of walk through at a high level. But we made a lot of changes in Link 2010 to make it an option for customers to deploy as a voice platform or a voice solution. If we look back, there was a slide that we used a couple years ago. There's a conference in the U.S. that used to be called PBX Connect, and then it was VoiceCon, and then it was Enterprise Connect the last year or two. And part of that conference, they have a UC statement of work or UC RFP, which lists the traditional features that you would have for requesting a unified communications voice platform. And in the OCS timeframe, we were just a small subset, around, I think, 30 or 50% of the capabilities that a voice platform would have. But by the time we released Link 2010, we were up to about 92 or 95% of those voice features or voice capabilities. What was missing is some of the items you see here. So we have some additional capabilities or features around the concept of enterprise voice that help close that last gap between what an existing telephony solution provides versus what a Link 2013 telephony platform solution can provide. We still have the concept of a single dial plan, so you still manage your dial plan centrally in Link, even if you deploy things like survivable branch appliances to your other locations. The policies will flow back, will flow down to those devices from a central administration or organization. You're not required to manage each one of the Link endpoints individually with perhaps a different interface or different set of credentials. The capabilities that are new apply to something called session management, or as another way to phrase it, Link now can be an intersection in your voice deployment, not a destination. So we can have inter-trunk routing, being able to route calls from the PSTN through Link to an existing PBX or vice versa, or from a PBX through Link to another PBX, which is a new capability in Link 2013 compared to earlier versions. In terms of providing better availability and routing options, we also have the concept we call M2N in terms of gateway and routing, meaning that a gateway can have multiple paths or trunks coming back to the Link mediation service, and the Link mediation service can have multiple trunks or paths to the gateways that you have deployed. This applies a lot more flexibility in creating your dial plans and routing voice calls in the organization. This also provides an additional level of availability in the case we have a failure either on the Link side or on the gateway side. We made some changes around caller ID and our presentation controls. We'll cover that, again, as we said, more in the voice session. Delegates have been a persistent source of feedback from all of you. Everyone asked for more capabilities around delegates. So we'll talk about some of those delegate changes and how we've increased the number of options you now have for the Link delegate experience for people who are handling calls on behalf of someone else in the organization. The final ones, right, is we've announced support this summer with the concept of Link to Phone for Office 365. So for basic voice capabilities, we can now take an Aries-style phone that you see down at the Polycom or HP or other vendors' booths outside, have that phone upgraded to the current version of the Link client, and that phone now can connect either to an on-prem Link infrastructure or to Office 365 for direct inbound dial services. We'll cover more about kind of what that entails and some options around on the voice side, but we're happy to announce that dial tone service essentially for some users in your organization coming back to that cloud service. Another major area of investment is around video. We'll do a demo this afternoon with Val here around the meeting experiences. That's going to show us the new client. The way I present that session is we're going to try to keep it to no more than 15 or 20 minutes of talking or PowerPoint slides and keep it about 45 minutes or so of actually just walking through the Link client and showing you how it works and what has changed from a voice perspective, a video perspective, and a meeting collaboration perspective. So we'll see a lot of the meeting changes this afternoon on the demo. But at a high level, what we've changed is we now have support for HD video in the conference scenario. So prior, we had HD video support for peer-to-peer calls. Now we support up to 720p video from an AVMCU or a Link conferencing perspective. We also support the capability of multi-party video. So we can have up to 5 concurrent video streams or presenters, for example, inside of a video call, and then a larger number, right, of people who are in the sitting row, for example, will see their pictures along the bar, and we can dynamically move people from that sitting row up to the live video stream window as an individual participant in that call. The coming from MS Research is something we call smart cropping. We understand that the video experience with a laptop and a webcam or a desktop and a webcam isn't always best situated in terms of where the person is sitting and camera placement and lighting. Smart cropping allows us in Link to essentially determine where the person's head is and to try to center that in the video square. So rather than getting sort of half of a head or the head off to one side or too high or too low, we will present that video experience for the multi-party video in the one that's most appealing or visually appealing from an end user perspective. The other big change is around codecs. We've announced support now for the H.264 SVC codec, or Scalable Video Codec. This actually, in a way, from the Microsoft perspective, appears to validate kind of what we had been talking about for the past 10 years. One of the sessions we cover on Friday afternoon, we've talked here in the past, is the concept of adaptive codecs. There's kind of two philosophies of how to overlay real-time media on an existing data network. In a TDM network, we have that concept of a dedicated circuit and dedicated bandwidth, and so we always know we have a very predictable, essentially, quality of experience. When we go to a data network, we're dropping packets onto the network, and those packets will take different paths as they arrive at their destination. Some may get dropped, some may be congested, right? Some may be altered in transit. And so as a result, we have some questions then of how do we take a real-time codec when we know that the underlying network is going to be making these changes. And there's two approaches. One is we can take some effort around the network to try to place in reservations and a certain quality of service and try to reserve or prioritize that traffic or bandwidth and do things around right-sizing the network to ensure that we have an appropriate experience when we drop this real-time codec there. Second is let's put some feedback mechanisms into the codec itself so that the endpoints are actually transmitting information around packet loss and jitter and latency during the call itself so that the endpoint can tune which codec and are things like forward error correction being applied. Microsoft has chosen the latter path for a couple of reasons. One is it does not require then a full network change or upgrade prior to deploying Link on the network. We will adapt to those underlying conditions due to that feedback mechanism in it. And the second is that we see the concept of these codecs not just running inside of an organization, but also over the unmanaged internet. And so anytime we're talking about an unmanaged network, having that ability to do real-time feedback during the call allows us to change those conditions and then essentially have the best experience we can have for that underlying network condition at any given point in time. And that brings us back to H.264. One of the main advantages, there's a couple big advantages to H.264. One is that H.264 SVC, or scalable video codec, allows us to dynamically update the frame rate per endpoint as it's leaving the AV MCU. That means that if we have some participants who are on a slower connection or a bandwidth congested link, for example, we're able to dynamically reduce the frame rate with very little activity required at the CPU level. We don't have to change codecs. We don't have to change the frame rate that's being encapsulated in the meeting. The codec itself is able to do that, so we can send some commands and then therefore ensure that the participants on the slower link have a video experience, but they might be 10 frames per second or 12 frames per second, whereas someone on a faster link might be getting the full 30 frames per second on that codec with little overhead or performance impact. The second one is that H.264 has kind of gelled around an industry standard from the concept of tablets and mobile devices. And so as we look at the prevalence of these as users device modalities, as users use them, we're able to leverage the processor or the hardware chipset in the devices to do the encoding and decoding, and we're not then dependent on the actual processor in the device. Most tablets and cell phones have a H.264 compliant chipset for the encoding and decoding process. That, therefore, enhances the video capability on those devices when we use that as a codec. We still will support VC1 for backwards compatibility with people who are a Link 2010 client, for example, or an OCS R2 client joining the meeting. But from a native Link 2013 perspective, we'll prefer H.264 for the reasons I mentioned above. The next one is around web conferencing. So we've had web conferencing as a capability for a couple versions now, OCS for Link. We actually see this as one of the most widely adopted use case scenarios from an end user perspective. By my normal day job, I spend between half to two-thirds of my day on a Link call where someone's sharing out their screen or desktop or doing a PowerPoint display and we're walking through or collaborating on one of those sessions. Our changes for 2013 is, first of all, we understand that when you organize a Link meeting, not all the participants will have Link 2010 or Link 2013 clients on their machines. As a result, we want the join experience to be simpler. We don't want them to have to go download the attendee client to get that full audio and video perspective. So from 2013, we're happy to announce Link Web App, which gives you the audio and video capabilities as well as web conferencing in a supported browser platform. So now we have end users being able to join a Link meeting that you host from that browser and not having any thick clients that have to be installed. We do have a little caveat, right? It requires a browser plugin for this to take effect. The browser plugin does not require administrative level privileges. It takes 10 to 30 seconds or so, depending on your bandwidth, to install that browser plugin and then go through and join the meeting itself. The other area that we're happy to talk about is the concept of the WAC server role, or the Office Web Apps, or Web App Companion Server that can be deployed. With OCS and Link 2010, we used to use a rendering engine developed by the Link team to share out a PowerPoint or Office document. And so as a result, our rendering capabilities were not as fluid as a native PowerPoint presentation would be. For example, streaming audio and video would not work if that PowerPoint was uploaded and was streamed out. It was just the slide display itself and some of the transitions. The last couple years have seen the Office team develop this concept of Office Web Apps. And so this is being written by the PowerPoint team itself. And so if you have the WAC server role deployed, we're able to leverage that in Link 2013 to have a much more fluid and idealized rendering of that PowerPoint or Office document information from an end user perspective. That gives us the capability of things like audio and video streaming that we wouldn't have with the native Link rendering experience. And then finally, for the folks that don't have Outlook deployed and are using OAuth as their primary mail experience, we're happy to announce that with Link 2013, we now have scheduling built into the Outlook web app application. So you can schedule Link meetings from a browser. You're no longer required to launch the Outlook client with the Link add-in to that for that meeting scheduling experience. So changes around web conferencing as well. Mobility. We understand mobility to be a trend that's only increasing over time. We've added the Link mobile client in 2010 after RTM. But your management and support of that was a little bit different from the native Link tools. With Link 2013, mobility is part of the actual Link deployment package. It's a service that will run on the front-end servers. It's managed by a topology builder and PowerShell and Link Server Control Panel, your existing Link tools. It becomes just another method of users accessing or reaching back to the Link environment. The other piece of this, right, if you look at the bottom subset, we're also happy to announce that eventually, post-RTM, so not at RTM, but after RTM, we'll be adding voice and video to our mobile clients as well, including over 3G, 4G, or Wi-Fi, 3G and 4G, not just over Wi-Fi. So now you're able to join meetings and have that video, conferencing, audio, other aspects around that. I hear some mini applause on that one. We know that's long overdue, but thank you. We're excited to bring that one out as well. So same basic concept. If you deployed mobility with Link 2010 today, the architecture is the same. You leverage a reverse proxy box and a service running on the front ends for that mobile story. We mentioned earlier on, but we have the capability for persistent chat. Persistent chat has now become, sometimes we use the phrase, a first-class citizen in the Link product family, meaning that the Link client now is able to access both your standard instant messaging, your conferencing, audio and video, as well as a back-end persistent chat pool. It's still a separate server deployment. You have the option of deploying a persistent chat pool, but you no longer have a separate client, that has to be leveraged to actually access that persistent chat pool. So with Link 2013, one client gives you capability to all the Link 2010 modalities, as well as the persistent chat capability here. We also have the concept around disaster recovery. In the past, persistent chat kind of worked as its own process for doing failover and availability. We brought the Link model around high availability and site resilience to that persistent chat capability as well. So you have a back-end pool, or a Link pool, providing your instant messaging, conferencing, and AV capabilities. You'll have a persistent chat pool providing your persistent chat capabilities, but your failover experience and your end-user experience will be consistent across both of those devices or platforms. All right, let's talk a little more about the maintenance and operational aspect. Now, we mentioned how this has been an investment area due to the desire of the developers, right, to reduce the number of support calls and issues that they're seeing. So let's walk through and see what some of those changes are. The first one is that we still have the concept of standard edition and enterprise edition for our server roles. The only difference being standard edition, one server per pool, enterprise edition, multiple, you know, up to multiple servers per pool, providing some level of local high availability at the pool level. But all link functionality, right, so our audio, video, our conferencing, our instant messaging, our web conferencing, is available in a standard edition server deployment. We also have the capability of doing pool level failovers with standard edition, which provides a modicum of high availability for a simple two-server standard edition paired pool deployment. We'll walk through Ewan's demo later. We'll show us what this execution process is to execute a pool failover, and that pool failover process will work in the same process for standard edition or enterprise edition paired pools. The other portion, right, is we still provide all the voice access and capabilities, so you can integrate a standard edition server with a SIP trunk, with an IP PBX or IP telephony solution, or with a gateway from one of our partners to bring that voice infrastructure or add enterprise voice access to a single server or paired pool deployment of standard edition server. We are targeting scalability at 5,000 users, which has been our guidance for R2 and for Link as well. That number obviously subject to change, but what we understand today is our target around planning and supporting that. Also, we have the concept of an enterprise edition pool, right, or a scalable system. An enterprise edition pool essentially allows us to have multiple front-end servers servicing that same pool. We do have some changes around that. First of all, we're going to increase the number of front-end servers that can handle an existing pool. Before, that was 10. We're targeting around 12 to 20 with Link 2013. We don't know what that final number will be yet. We'll be publishing that as we get closer to RTM. We're also increasing the number of users that can run in a standard edition pool. Our target here is up to 200,000 active users and up to 1 million provisioned users. So significantly increasing the scalability, essentially, which applies not for everyone, but for a subset of our customers. That's been very important for them to ask. The other portion is around making it flexible. One of these changes has been around the concept of the director role. We've made the director role optional in Link Server 2013. Directors previously were required when we had a multiple pool deployment, as there was some information when you would authenticate that a director would provide around your primary pool and your backup pool for resilience that wouldn't necessarily be provided if you signed into one of the front-end pools directly. We now provide that information in the standard pool sign-in process, so that concept of getting additional information when signing into a director is no longer relevant in Link Server 2013. We also increase our capabilities around federation and remote access. We'll cover a little bit more of that towards the end of the scenario session. We're happy to announce some increased support around our federation capabilities, as well as the capability of enhancing that federation with the concept of having a couple of endpoints available for that. So a lot of customers were restricted by the concept of one endpoint for federation or one link edge pool that could be associated with federation. Now we can have that endpoint stretch across a couple locations so you don't have that manual change process in the case one of those sites or locations becomes unavailable. We mentioned the concept of a smaller footprint. We've merged a lot of the functionality onto the front-end server. So if we look at this, right, some of the things we've added, we didn't mention it on the last slide, but one of our federation changes is adding XMPP support natively to the Edge server role. This allows us to federate with XMPP systems without having to deploy the XMPP gateway per XMPP domain that we might want to federate with. So adding XMPP support goes to the Edge server, but we do have a service that runs on the front-end server that helps enable that XMPP-type communication. We also have Link web app, conferencing, mobile, right? All of these are additional, the monitoring and archiving service, for example. Rather than those being separate components, we now are separate server roles. All those run as services on the front-end servers. Part of this comes from the fact of, so people might ask, right, wow, you've taken kind of a different approach over time, right? If you look at earlier versions, you kind of broke out all these different roles into different servers. Now with Link 2010 and 2013, you're seeing some consolidation around this. If you saw the Exchange session this morning too, right, you saw this concept of role consolidation occurring. And it's simply, it's not so much a grand master plan as it is the logistics of hardware. When we developed the earlier versions of OCS, we were looking at a the mid-range server that organizations would buy as maybe four cores being a lot of cores, right? Now that concept of a two-socket server might have 16, 24 cores available to it. And so the amount of CPU utilization we have in a standard two-socket server has increased dramatically over time. The more CPU utilization we have per physical device, the more services we can co-locate on these servers and therefore have a very modular style deployment algorithm. So the simpler it is it's very simple for us to say deploy X front-end servers, each one of them with identical configurations. We'll have all the services running on those. If you have a failure of any one of those, you'll have an uninterruptible service from an end-user perspective. Another way to look at this is to say, let's say we had two front-end servers running registration and mediation, and two dedicated AVMCU servers. We could only lose one of each of those pools. If we lost two servers at the front-end service, right, we'd lose the entire pool. If all four of those run the services co-located, we could lose any two, right, and potentially even three, depending on our sizing, before that service is impacted. So the more we can modularize the services running on the physical or virtual servers and have that a brick-level approach, the more we can increase the availability, essentially, in the organization. We have the non-link roles. You're familiar with a lot of these. Active Directory, Exchange UM is still the voicemail platform for link. We show the monitoring capability there. That's just the SQL database. So in Link 2010 and prior, we had a dedicated monitoring server role, maybe co-located with archiving. That was the endpoint for all the devices and computers sending their call detail records back to that monitoring server. It would capture and queue them and submit them back to SQL. That endpoint is now just the front-end servers in the pool, but we still have a SQL database which is storing and capturing all of those call detail records. Exchange also can be our archiving repository. So with Link 2013, you have a choice. You see that it mentions UM and archiving there, of having SQL be your archiving platform or archiving your links, your link IMs off to Exchange and having them stored in Exchange databases. We still recommend monitoring the health of your environment using System Center or a monitoring solution. And as well, we mentioned earlier the concept of the WAC role, which provides that rendering experience for sharing out documents, presentations, et cetera, for users who are coming in from a browser-based client. Let's talk a little bit more around our availability and site resilience plans and story. So first one, right, we have the concept of moving away from SQL clustering towards SQL mirroring. This provides us some capabilities around reducing the requirement for shared storage and simplifying the SQL availability story. If you look at SQL clustering, that's very reminiscent of the Exchange 2003 era with shared storage and multiple servers attached. You lose a shared storage, the whole infrastructure is down. SQL mirroring allows us to have two separate SQL servers, each with local storage. Either one of those instances fail, that pool will still be up and available. And so bringing SQL mirroring simplifies that back-end SQL architecture for link deployments and provides, from our experience as well, a higher level of availability. We also have some capabilities around pool high availability. We'll talk about this concept of pool resilience coming up in a slide as well. The other characteristics is this concept of how we do availability inside of a pool. So if you deploy an Enterprise Edition pool, we create automatically these concepts called user groups, and we randomly sort of provision the users, or Link does when you provision users, into one of these user groups. We have moved, first in Link 2010, we moved registrar and routing from SQL off to the front-end servers. With Link Server 2013, we moved the transient information, so things like present state, for example, off of SQL and onto the front ends as well. A couple reasons for this. One, we're trying to reduce the disk I/O requirements on SQL and remove that from being a bottleneck from our scalability. On two, just providing those services closer off to the front end servers and then having that information be replicated among them so that we don't have this concept or capability of a loss in service just because one of the front-end servers crashed or went down. Our permanent data, so contact lists, right, call forwarding information, for example, response groups, will still be stored in SQL on the back end. We try to move as much of the information closer to that user front-end experience as possible to reduce the capability or requirement for SQL, or dependency on SQL for that service to be alive. This means that if we lose our SQL backend, we still can sign into the pool, right? We can still see presence information. I won't be able to change my contact list, or I can change it, but those changes will be queued up on the front-end server, right? So transient information is all on the front-end servers now, and we'll cache that non-transient information until that SQL backend comes back. And so this effectively increases availability by ensuring that the loss of that backend component does not necessarily bring down that entire pool and the functionality or end-user functionality in the pool. So yet another example of that modularity approach that we're trying to bring that helps bring the concept of availability to Link. Here we show the HA model, right? The concept of number of servers and the number of users per pool, as we said, is going to be defined closer to RTM, but we know we'll be increasing those based on these concepts between moving services from SQL and other performance gains that we see writing on the front end. As we mentioned, right, this concept of user groups adds to that high availability architecture. Essentially, those users are provisioned into groups. If you have enough servers in the pool, there will be three user groups, or three a primary, secondary, and tertiary server that will be handling the front end or the specific user's transient information. So if the user's primary server is down, a user automatically knows to contact their secondary. If their secondary front end is down, they will automatically contact their tertiary, and they will have that presence information, ability to sign on, an ability to use Link inside of that organization. The rights of permanent information, user makes a change to their contact list, for example, will be queued up and cached on those front ends until that back end service comes back and becomes available again. So this is the, to reiterate, right, this helps reduce the requirement of having a highly available SQL infrastructure, because losing SQL no longer means the loss of user services on that front-end pool. So how does it work? We have three boxes, right? In this case, we only have three servers in the pool. Same concept would apply with more. We only have the concept, though, of primary, secondary, and tertiary. Bob's primary, for example, is front-end one. We lose the back-end. We lose the front-end. Bob can continue to work, right? At that point, he'll just re-sign in to one of the other front-end servers in the pool and have all of his services available. We replicate by a synchronous replication to those three nodes the permanent information, and our transient information will replicate off as well to the other servers in that user group as well. We also take the concept of security strongly at Microsoft. You're probably aware from seeing in the press around the before the Vista timeframe, right, we had taken a lot of flack around our Windows XP deployments that were out there and some of the worms and viruses that were spreading. We stopped coding in that 2005-2006 timeframe. All developers had to go through a security training, essentially, to make sure they're writing and managed code and looking at things like the common buffer overruns as things that have to be monitored or watched for in their code-based development. Link also ensures that all communications are encrypted end-to-end. Link is actually the only product on the marketplace that can meet a in the U.S. government something called FIPS 140-2 compliance. FIPS 140-2 specifies which encryption algorithms may be used by a supported software product. The reason behind this is that there are some encryption algorithms that are more susceptible to compromise today, as the graphics cards, for example, and CPUs become more powerful. There's other encryption algorithms that still require weeks or months of processing power to break that encryption. FIPS 142, therefore, is a requirement for a lot of organizations. Link supports using FIPS 140-2 compliant algorithms to increase that, not just having everything being encrypted, but also ensure that the specific algorithms being used are the appropriate ones, which are still relevant in today's security-conscious marketplace. We also have the concept of leveraging Active Directory, right? So we don't have usernames or passwords or other information stored in databases or memory or something on these front-end servers and Link server roles. We've had great success over the years in ensuring that we can have a secure and widely available Active Directory authentication and access control system deployed in organizations. So it makes sense for us to leverage that versus have the Link admins be responsible for maintaining and encrypting and ensuring SALT is used and other things like that at the password level. Site recovery. We mentioned this concept of pool-level failover. In Link 2010, we provided pool-level failover for voice services. So if you had two pools, you could have a primary and backup registrar or endpoint. If your primary pool went down, your client automatically knew to go sign in to the secondary, your backup pool, and maintain voice services. You could place and receive phone calls, right, and maintain that core voice component. What we found, however, is a lot of customers really wanted the instant messaging and the conferencing capabilities to be extended to that as well. We have the capability in 2010 to manually script this. You can export certain configuration items, copy those to the second pool, have them waiting there on standby, and have a process for importing and making those available when you go through your pool activation process. With Link 2013, we've built this into the product. We'll have Ewan walk through this in a moment so we can actually see what this pool or site level failover means. This means that these pools do not have to be close to each other. We can do pool level failover, right, kind of regardless of the distance involved between them. So we used to do the concept of metropolitan area resiliency in Link 2010, but we had a 15 millisecond latency requirement and synchronous data replication requirements to achieve that. Pool level failover requires neither of those. So we've opened up the capability of having this concept of two pools. Those can be standard edition or enterprise edition pools. We pair them, 50% of the folks on each, for example. Either one fails, half your users are not impacted, the other half come back online as soon as you activate that pool failover process. So with that, let's go ahead and see what this looks like. Turn it over to our demo god extraordinaire.
Thanks very much for that, Andrew.
No pressure.
Yeah, there you go. So before I start the demo, get a nice pink tinge. I did ask for blue, but pink was all they had today.
It is beta code.
Yeah, I'm doing a bunch of stuff in this lab, which is definitely not recommended. So I've got the Link client running on my domain controller. I've got release candidates, operating systems. I've got different operating system versions between my primary and backup pools. All of this is bad stuff. Don't do it. I'm an engineer, so I've got to have a bunch of different versions of things to test things out for bugs that come in. So that's my caveat.
So you're saying interop works well.
Yeah, interop works really well. Fantastic. So the first part of the demo, this is the bit that has to work. If this doesn't work, then might as well just go home. Signing into Link. Tense, nervous moments.
Nothing like waiting when you don't know what will happen.
I tried this earlier on. It was working really well. And it was really quite a bit faster than this, too. Yay, here we go. All right,
step one.
Thank you very much. Round of applause. Awesome. So, yeah, signed into Link. And if I have a look at my client, if I do a control right click on the icon in my notification area, I have configuration information surfaced there. And this shows me where I'm connected to from a pool perspective and from a number of other perspectives for all the functionality that we need at the back end for the Link client to do what it needs to do. So we can see that we've got the pool that I'm connected to. If I have a look at this, my connected Link server is pool1.ewan.mac. As a Scotsman, I am hoping that we eventually get our own top-level domain of .mac, but that's for the future. So that's where I'm connected right now. And if I show you the topology that I have, I've got the topology builder right here. Again, this is not recommended. Typically, if you're going to have a primary and then a backup pool, you'd have them in two separate sites and they'd be in different locations. These two pools are all in the same site and they're all running off my single SSD drive, so not very highly available. But I've got pool one and I've got new pool. I ran out of naming ideas after pool one. Pool two just seemed too obvious. So pool one is where my users are currently connected to. And if I edit the properties of pool one and scroll down inside here a little bit, what we should see is that underneath resilience we have an associated backup pool. And from that drop down, I'd be able to choose one of the pools that I've deployed inside my topology as a backup pool for that. That immediately sets this pool as the backup pool for the other pool. So as soon as I choose new pool as the associated backup pool for pool one, that automatically populates the associated backup pool for new pool to be pool one. So you don't have to go in and do that. So into PowerShell, where it all gets fun and exciting. I just punch a keyboard. So what I'm going to do initially is just do a get CS pool, and I'll have a look at pool1.ewan.mac. And that's going to show me, as you saw in Topology Builder, the associated backup pool there is newpool.yum.mac. What we want to do is kind of simulate a failover. Now, there's a number of ways that failover can work, and there's a number of ways that you're going to handle failover depending on the way you've deployed this. So there's mirroring that Andrew mentioned earlier on. I've got a really simple setup, so I'm not using anything particularly novel. So I'm going to do a manual failover between these two pools. So if we go back to PowerShell, we shall do get CS pool backup relationship. And I'll have a look at pool1.yum.mac. And that tells me that I have a backup relationship with newpool. So my users will be able to fail over there in the event that pool 1 becomes unavailable. And I follow, in my lab environment specifically, these manual steps. It doesn't have to be manual, but in my lab environment, to keep it nice and simple, I decided to go with manual. What I'm going to do is look at my central management store. And I want to have a look at the central management store status. The CMS, central management store, is one server inside your link deployment that's responsible for pushing out changes to all the link servers in the environment. So when you make an administrative change, a configuration change, this guy is going to be responsible for pushing those changes out into the environment. And what we can see here is that the active master FQDN, or effectively the head boy of the link topology right now, is FE1. So when I make any administrative changes, FE1 is the server that's going to be responsible for pushing those changes out to all of the other servers in the environment, which is kind of a problem for me right now because I want to take pool 1 offline because, you know, data center might flood, whatever is going to happen, the power could go out. So the first thing I need to do is try and move that central management store to another server. And that's done with PowerShell command. So if I do an invoke CS management server failover, what I'm going to do is specify my backup SQL Server FQDN. Now, if I go to pool 1 inside my topology and I have a look at the pool right here, you can see that my SQL Server store that's associated with pool 1 is SQL 1. And for new pool, it's SQL 2. So what I want to do is start moving the CMS and the responsibilities of that across to SQL 2 and across to new pool. So new pool and SQL 2 then do everything in the environment. So if I take pool 1 and SQL 1 offline, everything's going to continue working. And what I'm going to do is just close that down for a second. So we're signed in on pool 1 right now. Incidentally, I'm getting these error messages saying your chat room isn't accessible. That virtual machine isn't on right now. So those are expected errors. Those are good errors. So the backup pool FQDN is going to be SQL 2. And my backup instance name, I've got a SQL instance of link. I knew I'd do that. And I'll use the hyphen force parameter just to make it work. So we got to wait a moment or two for this to happen. It will happen. Tested this like 4 or 5 times. Ah, there you go. Are you sure you want to do this? So what we're going to do is fail over the SQL management server, the SQL management store, the file store. If you're familiar with Link 2010, you'll understand what all these components are. If not, come back to the other sessions. But essentially, I'm saying move a lot of the management administrative stuff across to my second pool. And there we go. So that's worked. What I need to do now is have a look at my CS management store replication status just to have a look at whether that change has come through. And hopefully that should come through fairly quickly. So what we can see right now is the change has been made. So the PowerShell command completed successfully. But when we have a look at this output, we can see that we don't have an active master FQDN. That should change to something else. And if I go back and run that command again, it will change to something else really soon. And I can't do anything until it changes to something else. So there you go. Brilliant. Thank you very much. You were very close to getting a joke just then. I was running out of ideas. So that's cool. So now that I've managed to move that across, FE28R2, which is the guy I'm actually running on, so this is FE28R2 is the server that's inside Newport. So this is where I want to move everything to. What I'm going to do is an invoke CS Management Server failover. And the pool that I want to fail over Yes, it is. failover fell back. Marvelous. There you go. Failback we'll come to. We haven't got there yet. So we'll go to pool FQDN. The pool that we want to fail over is pool 1. And just to force it across, because I'm doing a demo and I don't want anything to go wrong, I'm going to say disaster mode. So that's effectively saying pool 1's offline. It's not available. And that, again, will take a couple of minutes. What's going to happen is, if you keep an eye on the link client on the left-hand side of the screen, you can see currently I'm online. As we do that failover, yes, I want to do this. As we do that failover, as a whole bunch of PowerShell stuff runs in the background, this is all stuff that we're going to do to fail across. What we should find is that, awesome, that it breaks. That's fantastic. Okay. So, has that worked? No, it hasn't. Well, whilst I figure out why it hasn't worked, we'll go back to the slides. Sorry? Where are we?
Pool FQDN.
Oh. Pool FQDN.
Newport.
Yes.
Ah, there we go.
Thank you.
Thank you. You see,
I think that deserves a gift.
It does. It does deserve a gift. I think, who said that? You, sir, you can have one of these. Would you mind passing it back?
Yes.
The problem there is I was trying to talk and type at the same time, which is clearly not going to work. All right. So, good weekend? Did you enjoy your weekend?
I did, actually. It was nice weather here.
Yeah.
While I wasn't looking at slides.
That's it. The joy of being an international presenter. All right, so Link has been signed out there, and Link has now signed back in again. That's how fast it was. Now, the interesting thing is, yes, we get a credential prompt. If I go to this guy and look at configuration information again, then we should find that we are now connected to newpool.un.mac. So the failover worked. Thank you very much. So the interesting thing about this is if we do a get CS user and have a look at if we have a look at the user in question, when we have a look at this, we'll see that the user's registrar pool, as you can see there, is still pool1.un.mac. So we haven't actually moved the user. We've just pushed them across their associated backup pool so they can carry on having linked services. And then at some point in the future, what we would like to do is an invoke CS pool failback. And the pool FQDN we're going to use is pool1.un.mac. And whilst that runs away in the background, and that will take a few seconds to run, what we should find is the link client just gets signed out and then signed back in again. So the engineering objective of this was a recovery time objective of 15 minutes. So you should be able to go from my pool's gone down or my pool is about to go down for whatever reason and be able to fail across to another data center with another set of services inside of 15 minutes. And that was definitely less than 15 minutes.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
All on a laptop, right?
I know.
Thank you, Ewan. And thank you for the audience participation there. I've done demos myself as well, and I can't tell you how nerve-wracking it is when you're typing those commandlets in, everyone's watching, and you're also aware of beta code and what can go wrong, and the delay of watching it is always a little stressful, so thank you. We're also happy, right? So we've covered virtualization with Link 2010, and we've announced virtualization support for all of the Link server roles. We will continue that support stance for virtualization for Link Server 2013. We will support hypervisors that are on the Windows Server SVVP, or the Server Virtualization Validation Program, as well as Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. The big change, right, is that now that Windows Server 2012 supports more than four cores, we're removing that four-core support stance limit from a virtualization perspective. So you'll be able to deploy any of your Link Server 2013 server roles with as many cores as your virtualization vendor supports inside of that. The other concept is that all workloads are supported. We have worked with all the major virtualization vendors to ensure that the hypervisor platform understands the relevancy of real-time codecs coming over the network and ensures that those get to the processor in a more rapid fashion than a typical network packet coming inbound. That ensures that our capabilities around audio and video don't suffer from frame loss or packet loss or what we might call staccato audio or that tinniness that you might hear as the MCU tries to congeal or fix the result of those delayed or out-of-sequence packets. The other change is around VDI. We've had a lot of customers asking around virtual desktops and virtual desktop support. With Link Server 2013, we're now supporting audio and video from a VDI terminal with a plug-in on that terminal. That essentially means that the signaling for that VDI session is going to flow back through your Link pool infrastructure. But once we start a media path, that would go peer-to-peer or from that terminal off to the Link MCU. And so therefore, we're not putting that audio and video media traffic back to that VDI host. So essentially reducing the media traffic from a VDI host perspective to further enable a broader range of deployment scenarios from a VDI infrastructure. Now we support that for the major virtual desktop or VDI infrastructure partners and folks. Just a quick list, right? We wanted to show you what's supported now in VDI. You now can see that the VDI capabilities will be very close to what a traditional desktop will provide from that end user experience or capability. So if you've got VDI, we're happy to announce additional support for Link Server 2013 around that VDI experience. Finally, we have some information around efficiency, right? So here we talk more about the concept of operations and migration and how Link Server 2013 brings some enhancements in these areas. The first one is around modern operations. We still have the concept of PowerShell. We've actually enhanced our PowerShell capabilities. One of the big ones there is around RBAC custom roles. Specifically, one of the custom roles that we've added in Link Server 2013 is the concept of a response group administrator. So today, when customers deploy response groups, it's a Link Server administrator that needs to manage the workflows and agent groups that are associated with these response groups. But there's been a request that that be delegated out to someone in that line of business who's working with the folks in that workflow or a manager there. So with the response group administrator, we can then delegate out the management of that workflow so someone in the business unit can set holiday hours or operating hours or change agents and agent groups that are associated with that specific workflow. They no longer have to come back to the Link administrator to request those changes. We're also happy to announce full support for IPv6. So now you can deploy Link Server 2013 on an IPv4 or an IPv4 and IPv6 or a pure IPv6 environment. We'll cover a little bit more about this Friday afternoon in the enterprise networking session where we elaborate more, but we now have full support for IPv6 and the Link Server 2013 product. And finally, same management interface, right? So we've added the concept of mobility and persistent chat in some of the areas that didn't have the same management tools in previous versions, all under the concept of Topology Builder and Link Server Control Panel, so you only have a single management platform for your entire Link deployment. In terms of Active Directory, we still support the concept of a single forest or multi-forest topologies, so you can have an account forest and a resource forest. You can have a central forest, or you can have a single forest type deployment for Link Server 2013. Migration. Our migration story for Link Server 2013 will be very familiar to those of you who have migrated from an version of OCS to OCS R2 or to Link in the past. Still a concept of deploying a separate pool, or what we call the side-by-side approach. So essentially you deploy a Link Server pool, then eventually deploy optionally a director as well as an edge and move users from their source pool over to the target pool. The change for Link Server 2013 around migration is at the client support level. In the past, we required you to deploy the pool first, move users from their existing version, or their existing pool over to the new pool using their same client, and then upgrade the client after we move them to the new pool. So essentially a server-side approach upgrade process. With Link Server 2013, we are happy to announce that the Link 2013 client works against natively against the Link Server 2013 pool or a 2010 pool. So in essence, that allows us now to deploy either the client first or the server first or in parallel. So essentially, you have more flexibility in the migration approach when deploying Link 2013 versus our previous versions that would require that server-first approach and then upgrade the client post that. Once the client was upgraded, no longer being able to swing them back as the new client didn't support talking to that legacy pool. Now, you can move users back and forth, and it doesn't matter which version of the client they have. We're able to retain that communication between those pools. We've added capabilities around monitoring. We still have the concept of the monitoring service. It runs now on the front-end server, as we said. And this monitoring is really what we're calling, in Link, what we might call call detail records. So this is, in essence, capturing statistics and metrics around Link operating in the environment on a per-call or a per-session basis. And so we're seeing, was the user using a headset? Were they using a laptop microphone and speakers? Were they using a voice over IP phone? What was the jitter, the latency, right, drop packets, all sorts of information on that per-call statistic that are stored back in this monitoring server database. The advantage to having this information, besides going back for billing purposes, is that we can really use this to help tune the environment. We find that issues are trend or surface in this monitoring server database rather rapidly. If we have a bad wireless access point, we're able to identify that in the monitoring server database because every call associated with that access point is going to show up with a little red. We will highlight that information for you. I think we've got some further slides that will kind of show the monitoring capabilities where a normal call will have the white background. If we're trending into an area where there were some issues, we'll put a yellow background there. If we know there were severe issues, we will highlight that in red. So it's very quick when you look at one of these reporting services databases to see whether or not there was audio quality or video quality with that call, and then to drill down to see where that call was placed, whether there's a commonality in endpoints, a certain network link, a wireless access point, for example, that then helps you go back to the other group in the organization and help resolve that issue that's occurring that's causing some end-user pain around audio quality. Finally, we're also happy to announce, as we mentioned earlier, on this concept of a dynamic workplace, this concept of being able to leverage a single archive store in the organization. So Link 2013 has the option of using your existing approach of SQL to store this data or storing this information in Exchange, which gives you a single repository for your email messages as well as your instant messages users are sending. We also then have the capability of defining a single policy around archiving that will apply both to Exchange, to Link, and to SharePoint in the organization. We have a consistent records management discovery process and records management retention process that's enforced across all three of these capabilities. That simplifies the discovery process in terms of not having to go to multiple silos to obtain that information. The way we do this is we've actually written a shim inside of Link that intercepts those data requests. And so we have the concept of the Link Storage Service, or LSS. This will take the information that's about to be written into a permanent store and abstract it specifically from SQL or from Exchange. So Link sends its information that needs to be stored into the Link Storage Service. The Link Storage Service will then look in Topology Builder to determine, did you select SQL as your repository, or did you select Exchange for your repository, and allow us to then fork that information to the contact store, to the archiving repository that you selected inside a Topology Builder. Finally, we mentioned some changes around Edge. The big changes here are twofold. One, we have support now for XMPP. That allows us to federate with systems such as Google Talk, Cisco Jabber, or other systems directly from the Edge server itself. You had this capability today with 2010 and prior, but you had to deploy a separate server role called the XMPP Gateway to achieve this federation. Now, by adding XMPP support natively into Link and the Link Edge role, Once you have the Link Edge server deployed, you have access to all of the public IM providers, right? So AOL, Yahoo, now Google Talk as well, Windows Messenger. You have capabilities also around Skype. So at RTM, we will have the capability for instant messaging and audio federation with Skype. So your Link 2013 users can place a call to any one of the couple hundred million Skype-connected endpoints located around the world. Also, of course, right, we have the capability to federate with Office 365, as well as any of the existing OCS or Link deployments that might be out there today. So goal is really to have Edge be this repository or single point of contact for your capabilities around federation, and for you to have the concept of multiple federation endpoints, so we can have two locations accepting that federation request in the case of an outage on one without having to go through that failover process manually for resolving your federation issues. But in essence, the goal here, right, is to augment or provide a wide variety of choices for your end users to connect to, therefore reducing the number of clients that need to be installed, but still allowing them to communicate with the other endpoints that might be out both inside and or outside of your organization. Yes, a question. I think it's the last slide or second to last one, so I'll hold you for 2 minutes. Hybrid, as we mentioned, is our new voice scenario. We're going to go over this one in depth in the voice session. This one essentially will allow you to deploy your instant messaging and presence users in the cloud, Office 365, but have your voice services routing and being managed via Link server deployment on premises inside of the organization. Since we go into that for about 20 minutes or so in the voice session, I won't go into significant more detail here. I just wanted to provide a little bit of relevance around this concept of the hybrid solution. So with that, and coming up to the questions, right, thank you for coming out. Hopefully here you've learned the hit list, right, of the 20 or so changes that we've announced for Link Server 2013 across everything from availability, to operations, to feature changes, to video, to mobile, to conferencing, right, that we'd be happy to bring out to you here and announce here on Link Server 2013. So with that, a couple things. First, we'll start taking questions. First, actually, we're going to do the giveaways for everyone in the room as we're pushing on time. And then we're going to two more slides. We'll show you the, my bad, related content. Forgot that was coming up. Here's the list of Link sessions that we have at TechEd 2012 here in Australia. We have more content for you on Link all day. This afternoon is meetings. Tomorrow morning we'll have deployment. There's a customer panel Q&A to talk to some customers here who have deployed Link and their experience and feedback with it. We'll go into voice improvements and the capabilities for integration with Link and existing PBXs in your organization, and close it out with discussion of the changes around networking or enterprise networking for Link Server 2010. We also invite you to download the Exchange and Link previews. Try them out. These are free downloads from Microsoft, right? That's actually what you can use to set up your own demo or take a look or evaluate the features and functionality. Get a business value assessment. Come to us for a Link technical briefing. We're happy to talk more about Link. We'll be in the booth if we're not in the sessions usually to answer your questions you may have around Link or Exchange. So complete your evals, get a chance for winning some prizes, and for coming out today, we want you to get some prizes, right? And so the way we started doing this is we're going to try to find the range of numbers on your badge registration. So you should see a number on your registration. Is anybody over 2,000 on the number there? A few folks. What's anybody over 3,000? We got a couple over 3,000. What's the highest number that we've got for those of you over 3,000? Anybody over 3,500? 3,100, 16? 3,451. Anyone beat that? Sold. 3,454. I think that we'll take that as our upper range bound. So the way we've done this is to go through. We actually use Excel, and we're going to do a random number generator. Oh, what happened here? We lose the slide or the desktop. There we go. Coming back. Oh, now I'm gonna have to move it over to the side to show. Actually, let's just do this. Windows P, same screen. Windows P. Where's my cursor? Duplicate. So we use. We said 34, 54. So we're gonna do a random number between 0 and 34, 54. And whoever's closest to this number will win a prize. 2947. How close? Anyone at 2950? 2946. we have a winner. We tried the question approach in the past, but it's really hard to find out who raised their hand. Oh, sorry? Second closest. We're going to do one more random number here. So let's try that again. Come on, get in there to edit. 34, 54.
If it's mine, do I still get the prize?
No. If you work for Microsoft, you are not eligible. 345. Anyone close to 345? Pardon? 362. Those of you who registered early on Sunday, this is your chance. All right. All right. 362 is the next one. Let's try that one more time. 3454. Last prize. 2436.
And it's the big one.
2427. Well, we're within nine. 24. 68? Sorry? 2460? We're within nine already at 2429. Is that the number I heard? Oh, sorry, 2427? 2427. Anybody closer than nine? All right.
Done.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. Hope you enjoyed the session. Look forward to talking to you all week. Thank you, Ewan, for getting the demo. And thank you for the gentleman was who pointed out the typo.
Yeah.
All right.